This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Book Group studio in Doppeltown, USA, it's Necronomapod with your hosts, Mike Stoffel and Mike Moncada. Episode 9, Brendan Connell's The Translation of Father Totoro, The Story of a Man and No Women.
And here we go again.
Here we go again.
Episode
9.0.
Is it 9.0?
Well, it depends on if we break this into two.
No, this will be a short one.
Yeah, this will be a short one.
Because it's a short book.
It's a short book. And the book this week is, as you may have already heard, Brendan Connell's first. Actually, it's not his first novel.
It isn't.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to find that. He has.
Would you call this a novel?
Yes.
Okay. I would call it a novella.
Well, it's a short novel, but I think it probably has the minimum number of words.
I would call it a bloated short story.
it's a sordid tale.
I think it's a short story that needs a stomach bypass, a gastric bypass.
A gastric bypass.
a linguistic bypass.
So, the book this week is The Translation of Father Totoro.
Yes.
Which we picked.
Well,
randomly. You picked.
It was random. You had given me a gift certificate to Shocklines,
mm-hmm.
which we thought would live on forever. And I get this frantic email from you saying, Shocklines is closing down.
Redeem.
And so I frantically searched through the offerings at Shockline, and this book was recommended. It had a category of sort of like virgin pick or something.
Yeah. Like a guaranteed good read.
A guaranteed good read recommended by, I don't know who, the Shocklines dude.
Shocklines dude, probably. Yeah.
And clearly, he's needing to sell books.
Yeah, he's got lots of inventory. He's got to move. And this was
so I sent for it.
And I sent for it too, and we got ourselves each a signed copy. Thank you, Mr. Brendan Connell.
Yes,
that's it.
It is signed.
Very exciting. So, Brendan Connell, as far as we can tell, is a new novelist.
He is a new novelist.
He's got short stories out there, but this is his first, like, kind of, I don't know, big deal, not big deal novel, but, you know, novel with a big,
I'm
bigger
sure it's
publisher.
Something his mother is very proud of.
Oh, yes. I mean, my mom would be very proud of
right.
this.
Right. Why don't you give the background of, like, the publisher and that process? Because even though it isn't really about the book, it is about the book. Because I think it has a great impact on the reading of this book.
Yes. This publisher is a publisher called Prime Books. And I don't know where these people are located or anything like that. I suspect it's a very small operation. Although they have bigger... authors, like
I think they're back alley publishers.
Back alley publishers, yeah, kind
with
of like
bloody gloves and coat hangers, bloody typewriters, bloody. Oh, I'll print your book for you, sister.
You look like you could use some understanding.
Looks like somebody has been shoving words up in the.
We apologize for that. No, but it's a small publisher, and they publish fantastic and horror fiction, as far as I can tell.
Fantastic in quotes. Fantastic not meaning stupendous, right?
Yeah, although I think some of their stuff is probably pretty stupendous. But they took a chance on this book, on this writer who's
an untested author.
Yeah, just coming up. He's got some stories out there. He's contributed to a number of anthologies, and he's had a novel, and so they gave it a read. And said, there's something here. And let's just pause at that. Would you agree that there is something here?
There is, yes, I would agree.
I would agree,
there
too.
There is something there.
If this book had crossed my desk as an editor, I would have said, yes, send me more chapters. I'm very interested in this book, and I will consider publishing it. And then, in fact, they did publish it. That's where the problems come in, I think.
That they publish it?
No. There's a difference between publishing and printing. Printing is when you simply typeset it and you put it between covers.
Typeset it and forget it.
It's, what, yeah.
It's just like the Showtime rotisserie. The Rocco Showtime.
And forget it.
Just set it and forget it.
Now, and to be honest, it's not really fair because they did promote the book. They set up signings and they announced it and everything like that. They published it. But I have a feeling that Prime Books is not big enough to really spend a lot of money on the book before it reaches print.
I think they're sort of the couch potatoes of publishers, sort of the loads of publishing.
This book, and I'm sure the author, in fact, I know that the author has heard this enough.
Because you went to his chat room or something.
Well, I think his Nightshade Books has a thread on this book. A thread, actually, that may be maintained by the author. Saying, hey, starting with, I think this book's going to be published. Prime Books is going to put it out to, here's the book. Here's what the cover of the book's going to look like. To a message saying, it's up. Everybody buy it. And then a bunch of messages from people saying, hey, I read your book. I thought it was really great. But. And it's the butt.
Oh, it's a big butt.
And it's a big
in
butt.
Plaid pants.
It's a big butt in plaid pants. And he talks about this because on this message board, people say, really enjoyed your book, except there's a glaring typo or misspelling on almost every page. And now I myself am very susceptible to that. It drives me crazy because of what I do.
Right.
You're not an editor. Was it driving you crazy?
Only the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah.
That drove me crazy. And
because it was wrong every
time.
It
was spelled S-I-S-T-E-E-N.
Yes. That is wrong.
And I looked it up every which way I could. I looked Oxford Dictionary. I went to, and that is not the way you spell it. Because I was going to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. It's not.
And then there were pages where there were, things should have been in quotes and they weren't. Yep. That stuff drove me crazy.
Yep. And so the author on this message board responds to this. He says, "Yeah, that's what you get when you copy edit your own book." So what that tells me is that Prime Books doesn't pay for copy editing; it forces the authors to do it, which.
Just hard to do, I would think.
Well, it's freaking impossible to do. You can't copy edit your own stuff because you don't know what you don't know.
It's like trying to cut your own hair.
Yeah. So probably had to proofread it as well. And this book was not proofread worth a damn.
Well, and then, because there's that, we were talking that this was a dog who has a name.
Yeah, he has a name. And the first letter of the name probably has some sort of accent, probably like a Czech or, no, it's a Slovenian accent.
Yeah.
The typesetting program, and now this is not the author's fault, necessarily, because when you send it to the printer, things just drop out, and somebody at the publisher should be turning these pages and looking for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And nobody did.
They didn't. So there's a letter missing.
Yeah.
So you see a blank space
in
and
every
letters,
face.
And you're like, well, what the hell is this?
It's really, really shoddily put together. And it's a shame. It's really a shame because my opinion of this book, while I don't think I will be singing its hosannas, I would have a better opinion, I think, if it didn't piss me off at least once every page. Brendan Connell, if you're listening to this, and I don't know why you would, really, because we honestly don't know what the hell we're talking about.
He might Google it and then see that his name. Oh, yeah. Somebody's talking about my book.
Do some narcissist surfing.
Did you just make that up?
No, that's an old word. Next time you get a chance to publish your book and they force you to copy edit it, now I'm not kidding myself, I think, for certain small publishers, copy editing is expensive. It's about $1,000 a book. Just get a friend to look over it.
I'll tell you what, I am the worst speller in the world, pay me $500, I'll do it for you.
Yeah.
Because I'll be able to, Brendan, I know nothing about the English language.
Brendan, I am a professional. I will do it for $500.
I'll do it for $450, Brendan.
$425.
I'll do it for $421.
All right, Mike, edit that.
I don't know, bring it over to
So let's not talk about that anymore.
So
I had to register that, and that's it.
Yes.
All right.
I agree.
Yeah. It's important. If you're going to publish a book, you have to really, really publish it. You can't just print it. You can't just slap your manuscript down on the copying machine and sew it together with a yarn. This is not quite there, but it could have been a lot better.
Well, and if somebody's going to slap down some money to buy your book,
yeah,
and spend time with it,
yeah,
it's like going on a blind date.
Yeah.
And you know, you should put your best foot forward.
You know, and I don't blame the author for that with this book, because this book, what they're charging for this book, that's what we charge for books the similar length.
But listen,
with the same print, and we don't have subsidies.
This author could have had friends look at it.
Yeah, no, but it's the publisher's responsibility.
And you got to believe that he knows English majors.
Oh yeah.
So he could have had anybody look at it.
Writers don't have to be good spellers.
Right.
But publishers do.
Well, and you would think if you wanted your book to be published that you would want to do everything you could to make it
a
nice product.
Yeah. Now, this is his first novel, and he's just gonna say, you're going to publish my book? Yes. Whatever you want me to do, I will do it.
He was probably extremely happy that
his book. Yeah, you know, and he still should be, because it's a pretty good first book.
That's quite a qualifier.
It is a qualifier. It is flawed. It is grievously flawed, but it's got some real snap.
It is like a blind date.
I would go on a second date with this guy.
I might start off slow and go short story.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to like go kayaking
perhaps
with the person or anything
like that. Essay. Maybe an overnight camping trip.
Oh, that's
in separate tents.
Okay, separate tents. All right, that's good. You know, you drive.
And then go to first base.
But when I started reading this book, I was hooked. I read this book and nothing. It was just like, and it was great.
It was a quick read.
It was a quick and very.
It's a quick and
exciting,
dirty.
Quick and dirty read. It was very flashy and exciting, and there was something going on all the time. Sometimes there was a little too much going on.
Well, stop being so, what do you call it?
Am I being coy?
You're being coy to his coy mistress. What do you mean?
Well, it does come crashing down at the end.
When does it crash? Yeah, when?
It is not as squeezed together of an ending as I've seen, for instance, in other much
more. Heart-shaped box. For instance.
Oh, I disagree. I was thinking Necroscope.
Heart-shaped box.
Or perhaps Necroscope. but I don't know. I mean, I thought it was wonderfully sorted. It was a wonderfully sorted book. And it takes place... Well, I'll get to that. You go ahead and disagree with me. go say it. Go on. Do it. Do it.
There were elements. There were elements that I really, that were intriguing, and that I wish he would have spent more time with them.
Really,
and really explored them.
I agree. Which elements do you think? Are you thinking of?
The main element would be his learning of sort of the dark arts, let's call them. I think
yes.
It basically happened in two pages.
Yes, that would have been good.
And I think. Sort of going into that more, really fleshing that out, and then
you know,
sort of showing how this man changed, or how his exploration of this—it's almost like he was too smart for his own good.
Yes,
and it was his undoing.
Yes,
and I think tying that in with exploring the occult might have been more interesting.
Mm-hmm,
To see that progression. Things happen very... Whoops, pounding. Things happen very quickly.
Yes.
And you don't see the lead up to it so much. You don't get to savor it. It's
yeah,
just... It's like quick. If it was a movie, it'd be these quick cuts.
Yeah.
Or it would be a montage almost.
Yeah.
Of
the education montage.
It would be the. It would be like the Pretty Woman getting her clothes montage.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the whole semester in the space of a Fountains of Wayne song.
I thought that because it's a horror book, and because they say it's a horror book. Somebody said it was a horror book.
It was sold from a horror distributor, but it says nowhere on here that it's a horror book.
Okay, it's almost Faustian bargain or whatever.
Well, it's a very specific genre of novel that's very old, and we can I get into this now?
Go ahead.
All right, it's a gothic novel. It is the story of the deranged monk.
Is there a long history of the deranged monk novel?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
The
very first, what people identify as really as the very first horror novels. In fact, I just gave you one. The Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole is about the dark secrets of the Catholic Church. And it's very medieval.
Aborted babies under the rectory, kind of.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. That was the first one. That was like 1764 or something like that. And then became really popular. I mean, that was a big bestseller when it came out.
And then there's that whole, you know, I mean, it's not novels, right? But there's that all those histories of those monasteries where nuns and monks would go crazy and be possessed by the devil.
Yeah, I mean,
performing all sorts of strange.
Yeah, for some reason, and all the stuff about the original Gothic novels. I mean, they were trash. They were considered trash by you know.
They were like the Daniel Steeles of their time.
Yes, yes, or worse, like, you know, like Jerry Springer's of their time.
In book form.
The novelist who was really famous back then was Anne Radcliffe, would write about, you know, medieval things in Italy and the, you know, more Catholic decadence and, you know, wicked, you know, villains and damsels in distress. And again, deranged clergymen. And then the big one, one that I think this is really inspired by, is the book called The Monk by Matthew Lewis, who just became known as Monk Lewis, which is about this deranged monk who terrorizes
doing all
people.
The wrong things for the right reasons.
Yeah, no, but in The Monk, he's just evil.
He's just pure evil.
He's a bad guy. But also with Gothic novels, and this is something that Edgar Allan Poe picked up on, was, you know, the fascination with the Inquisition and Catholic torture and the saint stuff and the relics and the treasures of the Vatican and it's all of that. And this book is just plugged into that tradition in every way.
Huh.
So I speak as though I know what I'm talking about here. I have read none of those books.
You just read about reading.
I have just read about them. However, that said, I am, you know.
You know more than I do.
No. But I'm about to, because I was alive to this tradition. I was like, you know, I have to read some of this stuff if I'm going to be.
Yeah, kind of go more to the source.
Yeah, trying to speak about this stuff with any authority at all.
Well, it's clear that he's been to Italy. It's clear that he knows Catholicism.
Yeah, and he knows Rome like the back of his hand.
Yeah. And sometimes it felt like being in a travelogue.
Yeah.
A demented travelogue. Yeah. And I had been to Rome, and so a lot of those things were like, oh, yeah, I was there.
I mean, I was just kind of giddy with some of the details he would throw in, like, you know, the fact that when Father Turturro becomes Pope.
They check his balls.
Do they?
Yeah. They talk about it, making sure he was a male.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. Well, it seems like a good idea. You know,
there's nowhere that says they can't be a female, but supposedly.
Yeah. And there's Pope Joan.
And there was a lot of detail about the conclave and the voting. And
which was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was.
That was actually, and it was well done. It was described in just the right amount of detail.
And he had a good grasp of sort of the career priest.
Mm-hmm.
And there are. They would never admit that, but it is a career. It's an occupation.
It's a career choice.
It is a career choice.
A very involved one.
Yes. And they had a good he had a good take on that, and the demented, kind of the power that goes to people's heads, and kind of the demented sexual things, and
the demented sexual.
He has he definitely has an axe to grind with the Catholic Church.
Yes.
Nice Brendan, Irish boy.
Brendan
that he
Connell,
is.
Nice Irish boy that he is. I wonder, you think he's actually Irish? You think he's living on the Emerald Isle?
No, but I'm thinking he's Irish extracting.
Yeah, well, I caught some British spellings in here. I think he might actually be writing from over.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. I really like the detail of the specific street names in Rome.
Yes.
And
he did have a sense of place.
Yeah, it was that was really good. But I was going to say that I really liked the whole bit about the Pope. What was his name as Pope?
His name?
Yeah,
Cyrus?
No, it was Pope Le.
Oh, Pope. You keep vamping, and I'll look it up.
Yeah.
Lando.
Lando
the second.
Lando
Calrissian the second.
Pope Lando Calrissian the second. Pope Lando. Where he just turns the Sistine Chapel into his office, and he has an attendant out there who's just there on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to make him espresso. That's handy.
It is.
Yeah,
I've been in the Sistine Chapel, and it would be a wonderful office.
It would be a wonderful office, especially if you had an espresso guy there, and you could smoke. Chain smoke.
Yeah, he gets the decadence and the...
Yeah, I mean, it really plugged into that Gothic sense of Catholic, the decadence of the Catholic Church.
And
the,
I was really...
The horror of Babylon.
Yeah, and I was really waiting for sort of this, him to raise an army.
Yeah.
And to begin to sort of reconquer Europe and back the lands, the Vatican lands. And
I
thought that's where it was headed.
Well, actually, when he becomes Pope at exactly halfway through the novel, I just thought, oh, this is a rise and fall book. Mm. This is it. He's on top. Now he goes down.
He falls very quickly.
He does.
And he doesn't do much on his risen state. There isn't much...
Well, he does. He does some stuff, though.
He murders people. And
but he's a very popular pope. Yeah, he becomes a healing pope, which is really distasteful to the Catholic establishment. That smacks of American
Pentecostalism.
Bible Pentecostalism.
This stinks of Pentecostalism. But it all happens very quickly.
Yes.
I mean.
But he does other. He introduces other reforms and stuff like that too. Doesn't he reach out to? What does he? He reaches out to some other faith and.
And then destroys it.
I can't remember. Oh, but he's also a rival of the Latin Church, the Latin American Catholic Church, which I will bet you that's a real schism in the church. Especially now, but
there's all sorts of schism.
Yeah, but when we just had a papal conclave to elect a new pope, and most of the Catholics and the life of the Catholic Church on the planet is really in Latin America and Africa.
Well, that's where all the there's more priests being groomed
We're here in Doppeltown, which is the savage beating heart of Midwestern America. And it has a big freaking cathedral, and I've been to churches that have African priests.
Yeah. And they're much stricter. They're much more old school.
Yeah, they can't find domestic North American priests. They have to literally pluck them from Africa.
Right.
That's where the life of the Catholic Church is. But
the seat of the Catholic Church is Italy.
Yeah, the seat of the Catholic Church, and so they have Pope Palpatine. I mean,
Palpatine.
Benedict.
who has the coldest dead fish handshake.
I am sitting across the table here from a guy who has actually shook this man's hand.
I shook this man's hand before he became
Pope. He was still, he was Cardinal, right?
He was Cardinal Ratzkeller.
Colonel
Rumspringer. And he was I used the word a lot last podcast, but he was creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had one of those things where my body convulsed with the essence of evil running through me.
He looks creepy, and I try to get past that, but his various pronouncements, and I'm saying this as a recovering Catholic, so I guess I do have a leg to stand on. I find it horrible, and I'm becoming even more and more recovering.
I would almost want Pope Lando instead of Pope Benedict.
Pope Lando gets stuff done.
And was there a Pope Lando the First? Is what I want to know.
I don't know.
We never really looked it up.
No, I have to get out my big book of popes.
The big McCall's big book of popes. Scientific America's big book of
big
popes.
Big book of popes.
Highlighters, big book of popes.
But
with pop-up popes.
Pop-up popes. Now a fold-it-yourself miter.
Oh, Lord.
Sorry.
Dear Lord.
That's an old
Pope Lando, help us. He does become a saint in the end, Pope Lando does.
He does. Instant saint.
Saint Lando.
Circumventing all the rules.
No beatification. Because he had all the miracles.
Well, he did have the miracles, but there's a time. You have to, like, wait a certain amount of time before you can even beatify.
Yeah, a couple years or a year or something.
Yeah. But he's a pope within a year. I mean, he's a saint within a year.
Yeah.
He's just breaking all the rules.
I really liked... because this whole kind of the mystery of this begins with the disappearance of
St. Anthony's tongue.
Yeah, of different artifacts.
Oh yeah,
relics,
and
pieces of bone and leg and
tibias and fibulas.
Right, and that it turns out he's been gathering those, and he has them surgically. Magically and surgically inserted into his body.
That was like a Geek Love moment.
It was very
that was disturbing.
Disturbing, and that there's a. I had great hope for that book.
Yeah, but nothing ever happens with that. I mean, I guess you're supposed to assume that
He becomes sort of this saintly figure because he sort of takes in
the artifacts
of these saints.
Yeah, he literally embodies the miracles of the saints.
Exactly. Yeah. And he does this sort of in this occult way.
Yeah.
But it's not really. It's connected, but it isn't. I mean, meant to sort of fill in the blank.
I know.
And that's where it could have been really.
It's not made organic.
Fleshed out.
Yeah, it's not made sort of like organic to the story, to the novel, because later in the book, all these things get removed, and he still retains his magical powers.
Yes, he does.
To a degree. Yeah. That's okay, but it's never explored at all. The author never even makes a gesture towards explaining how that, making any sense of that. He doesn't have to make logical sense. It has to have to make like sort of
magical sense.
Magical
or,
sense. Yeah. It has to make magical sense. Yeah, and it doesn't. No.
Right. Well, he does have this knowledge. He does have this occult knowledge, and he had the knowledge before.
Yeah.
Before he brings the bones into him, he does cast these spells, and he does do these things.
Yeah.
So those bones take him to a different level. They give him a certain sort of power.
Yeah.
So you can kind of assume he had this sort of training, and he did learn these things, but you don't know exactly what he learned. And it becomes sort of a vehicle for an ending.
I mean, it's... This book... What it kind of reminded me of is another book that I think is pretty darn good. It's another first novel, and one that I also think is deeply flawed, although it was a huge bestseller.
Flowers in the Attic?
No. Jonathan Norrell
Jonathan Strange and
Mr. Norrell.
Yeah.
By Susanna Clarke.
That was quite a flawed book.
Yeah, it was a very flawed book.
And
but
thick.
And thick, but what that book did, it was basically kind of, it was sort of this same kind of magical, sort of slightly magical world, where you have these people gaining this knowledge because they're both very smart.
And they have egos, and they're in competition.
But in that book, she spends a lot of time fleshing out these little details,
right,
which can be annoying.
Yes.
And, it was, you know, it would get, so you go
to, like, who cares where the coffee pot was made?
Yeah, you get bogged down in this kind of stuff. But when you got to the end of the book and you close it, you had this accumulation of detail.
And you really were in this world.
Yeah, I mean, it pulled you, it slowly pulled you into the world and it percolated up around your ears.
That was a frustrating book for me.
Really? Oh, yeah. I love that book. But, yeah. But it frustrated me regularly.
Because it was so detailed.
Yeah.
Yeah. This book needed some of that.
It needed some of that.
It either needed that, or it needed to become a very short story with a quick sort of climax and a denouement and get it done with.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It was. I thought it was about the right.
You don't really know why he's so nasty. You don't get a sense. It's told to you, but you don't. You know, is it put in him? Is it how? Where is this coming from?
Where is it coming from?
His uncle says like two things to him, and now this is what he is. I mean, it doesn't make
because the character is very interesting, and explaining why he is like he is, I think, would make it even more interesting. I think it's a good character.
Well,
he reminds me of Salieri from Amadeus.
How?
He has this desire, this driving desire to serve God and to be good. But when he looks around and he looks inside himself, he sees that God hasn't given him that. God has not given him the ability to be good. And so he's like, all right, I'm gonna play the game. And without having the tools, I'm going to win. I'm going to win this game. Right. I'm going to be freaking Pope, and I am not going to believe in God.
I have to disagree with you because I think it's not like that. I think what this author is showing through this character is the nature of God, which is God will do things that look evil for God's own purposes.
You know, actually,
that is what the holy is. It is because,
well, remember,
it's almost like Job, you know?
Yeah.
Don't question the work of my spirit. This is what needs to be done.
Yeah.
And he thinks he's an instrument of that, and we're looking into the heart of God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at the epigraph that starts the book here. It's a quote from Robert Louis Stevenson. Religion is a savage thing, like the universe it illuminates. Savage, cold and bare, but infinitely strong. That was the perfect epigraph for this book. And it really, I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be a ride. And it was. It was a little rough and bumpy.
But do you agree with me with what I'm saying about...
Yes.
Yes,
I do.
Brendan's saying something about the nature of God through this character.
I would backpedal from that and say it's about the nature of religion.
I would so disagree.
Look at what is done in the name of religion.
It's not.
Really?
He's not doing it in the name of religion. He thinks he is doing the work of God. And that his power is God. Remember they talk about Adam and Eve and Cain and his other son. And that this was sort of the magic or that spirit that was sort of unleashed in the beginning of the world.
Okay.
And that's the work of God. That is the work of God. Mm-hmm. Not the religion's just a vehicle.
Yeah.
And yes, he makes a lot of comments about that vehicle, but then there's something that supersedes it. It's almost like an Ayn Rand sort of thing. There's this sort of overarching law, this overarching rule, and certain people can inhabit that world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where God is. That is God's nature. That is how God affects things. That is religion.
I want to be convinced by that, because I think that's, I want to believe that you are right. So I'm going to agree with you. That's what I'm going to say.
Why are you acquiescing so quickly?
No, because I'm not sure. I'm not sure based on my actual experience of reading the book. That is what it's about. I think I'm being a little ungenerous here. I think it might be more petty than that. I think it might just be a rundown of the Catholic Church.
I think it's a rundown of God. That would be freaking sweet. As displayed by the Catholic Church.
Okay. All right. I can. You know, yeah. I think we can agree on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which is freaking cool. I think that's a great thing to have a silly little horror novel about.
And God can take it.
God can take it. God doesn't care.
Maybe looking more into it than it was really there, but that's what I definitely felt like. If you,
well, I don't know. I think Brendan Connell is, I think he wants to take on some of the big stuff.
I think he does. I think maybe he needs to mature a little bit more.
Yeah, he just needs to keep writing.
Yeah,
keep writing.
Yeah,
and get an editor.
Yeah. Let's talk about the ending.
Okay.
Let's talk about the ending, and let's talk about the two, like, kind of seven, the movie seven things that happen in this book.
Oh, the, yeah. Okay, yeah.
All right, so the ending.
So the ending.
And this is his translation, basically, is the ending.
Yes, well, his translation is, he's constantly translating himself. Literally, he learns languages.
Yes.
Picks up languages. He
learns the language of magic and the language.
Yeah, he picks up basic Catholic Christianity and translates it through various other religions, the Kabbalah, like you were saying, and then he translates his body.
Yes.
From all of his own pieces parts to he gets surgically enhanced. And then he gets all that removed. He becomes
a cripple.
A beggar on the street.
Yeah.
And then translates in the ending to. Translates himself from.
Well, he gets translated into a saint.
Yeah, from
the church.
From a lowly, put upon, going nowhere priest to
the Pope.
The vicar of Christ on earth.
To a beggar. A priest again.
To a priest again. From dead to a living.
Yes. And from wounded to whole.
Yeah. I mean, he's in constant change. From chapter to chapter, there's 24 chapters in here. I bet you can pick a major translation that he undergoes in every single chapter.
That's true. Do you think he is redeemed? Do you think this is a book about redemption?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know, because I suspect... That you are not supposed to know. You are supposed to walk away with this book with that question mark. It's like, is this...
Because if this was written in a different way, and after he's a cripple, and then he dies, right? That would be sort of a Catholic redemption. You know, he suffers, he pays for his sins, and he dies.
He dies, and he's
but in the
born
end,
again whole.
Yes, but he doesn't earn that. He steals a body, basically.
Yeah, he steals a body. A body that, frankly, I mean, I wouldn't have put it past him to steal it, steal an occupied body, but the body was actually vacated.
Right.
And he steals a recently dead body.
And he almost kind of starts all over again.
Kind of does.
And it's like, oh,
so
he hasn't learned a damn thing.
I have to remember now. I finished this book a couple days ago, and I'm already trying to remember what exactly... What's the closing bit? He's now known as Father. Marco. No, Father Massimo.
Father Massimo. Right. And he goes back to seek out this nun who helped him.
Yes, and he pulls her. Yeah. This nun who was really a pure good.
Yes, she was like a sister, Mother Teresa.
Oh, there's another woman.
Right.
Okay. There's a couple.
Women are incidental to this story.
Yeah, oh, very much so. The last paragraph is the priest Father Massimo, who is Father Tartaglia is going under now, walked through the streets of Florence with long, virile strides. Mm. His well-polished shoes clicked along the bricks. His face wore an amused expression. He passed the Palazzo Vecchio and the historic Fountain of Ammanati. The sun shone on the tops of the buildings and onto the Piazza della Signoria. A cloud crawled before it and severed its rays. That last line.
Right.
I think it's specifically put there.
Right. To, it's not a happy ending.
It's to, no, it's just to put the question mark in your brain, in your mind. It's like, you know, this could be bad. This could be very bad. But he is still, you know, he's gone out and he's rescued this woman who's taking care of him and his need. And you think that's out of pure good gratitude.
Well, and he would think he was good. This was good.
Yeah.
He would, all of his actions, all of his supposed evil actions, he would see as this is necessary.
Yeah. I mean, literally
good.
I mean, what is his goal? Everything that he does to gain more power
for God.
And when he gets all the power he's going to get, what does he do? He does good works, except when his power is threatened, and then he, sets a cardinal on fire. He sets a
well. It's that whole, do the means justify the end?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really what this.
Yeah, which is an
that's
old,
what this
old,
book.
Old argument,
yeah, that's an old story. That's what this book is.
Yeah.
And what's the answer? What is the author saying?
You can. In this one, the author is saying, scratch your head some more. The argument
it's
continues.
It's hard to know.
It's hard to know.
It depends where you stand.
Yeah, because the people who die in this are...
Really need to die.
Not all of them. Not all of them.
Well, let's see. Who dies? There's the evil surgeon.
The evil surgeon.
There's his wife.
His
wife, loving wife.
Who doesn't really need to
and
die.
And the dog doesn't need to
die.
Yeah,
dogs never need to die.
No.
No.
And then there's
There's the pedophile priest.
And then
there's the gourmand priest.
Yeah, vanity and gluttony.
Gluttony.
And
who die in vain
sodomy.
And gluttonous ways.
And again, the American pastime of sodomy is given
what,
its
what
dues.
Did you, I thought those were a bit, those caricatures were a bit broad.
They were very broad. They were like Commedia dell'arte characters.
Yeah,
of,
yeah. But still, really fun
to read.
They
were wicked.
They were wicked. Very fun to read.
And then somebody else, who else gets sliced and diced? Is that it? Yeah, I think that's it.
That might be it. What? No. Well, he does. I mean, he does the thefts of the relics, but you know.
And then he returns them. Kinda. Well, and he's sort of, you know, in my former life, there were certain people who were very, what would you say, forthright and kind of righteous in their, you know, their conservative nature, mm-hmm. and they would be quite... unforgiving and a little devious, and to, you know, thinking that they were being holy and righteous and all that stuff. And
well, explain,
you
what,
could see
what specifically do you mean? So, well, your former life,
right?
You
deep in the bowels of Catholicism.
Yeah. Mr. Mike Moncada here was deep in the bowels of learned Catholicism.
Yes.
Yeah,
did you have to
like wear the black and everything?
I did. Not for special occasions. Not as a daily affair.
No. Okay. Good.
But there were people who.
It's a soutane, right? Is that what you call it?
Huh?
A soutane. The long coat.
We didn't wear the cassock.
The cassock.
We didn't wear that.
Oh, okay.
No.
All right.
But
what are you talking about? Devious and righteous. What are you talking about?
Well, I think because they. You know, they had that worldview that they were sort of...
they were God's instrument?
Yeah, and that they were a certain...
They were a witch's hammer and they would pound you over the head with it?
Yeah. And
that sucks.
Right, and they had their...
Hard to be friends with those people.
Yes, and you would try. You would want to embrace them and try to understand them, but... And they probably felt the same about you. They probably felt that you were wicked. And
yeah,
your own,
but in the end, they just pissed you. You just
it just sort
each
of pissed
off.
You off, but there was this sort of we know what the truth is, and this is, and the truth must be the truth must be gained, and the actions must be taken.
Yep.
And you know, forget the rest of
this is the main reason I'm a lapsed Catholic is because I cannot understand anybody's that anybody could be so smug as to say that they have the monopoly on the truth.
But this is it, right? I mean, this is what this guy says. I know who God is. I know what the truth is. I know what good is. I know how to serve good.
Yeah, see,
I know good has to be served, and sometimes in very wicked ways.
Yeah, speaking personally, I think that is the most evil thing in the world.
Well, and that's why this character Hugo.
Yeah, personally, I think this is an evil character.
Yeah, because he thinks he's good.
Yeah,
that's what makes him evil.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the author thinks that, but you know, it doesn't matter what the author thinks. This is that's what I think. You're right.
Yeah. What do you think the author thinks?
I don't know. I suspect that the author is on the same page as I am, but he's much more cagey than I am about this.
It's more obtuse.
Yeah, which is maybe the reason, maybe part of the reason that you don't get into Father Torturo's head very often.
You don't.
And I wanted to.
Yeah.
I really did.
Yeah. Yes, and I think that's what's missing.
That's...
In a way.
I say that's pretty much the only thing that's missing. Just a little bit more depth of the characterization.
Yeah. He's definitely like all action.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as action, I think this is a ripping story.
You know what? It's a kind of story that's been oft told.
Yeah, yes, right? It has. And it can be told some more.
Yeah, and it probably needs to be told.
Yeah.
Because it's happening all around us anyway.
I know. It's
everyone doing these really
300-year-old traditions.
Thinking they know what good is, and by God, we will burn the witches all.
The witches, yep.
Yep. And we will commit all sorts of atrocities for the...
So, I don't know.
Is there anything else you want to... We do have to say one thing, though.
What's that?
It's cocktail time!
It's cocktail time!
Mike, tell the dear folks what we are drinking.
Well, okay, so I thought about this long and hard.
Yes, you've been pondering.
For you know...
The emails have been flying.
flowing in. At first we thought, there's not a lot of drinking going on in this book.
There really isn't.
They enjoy Chianti.
Yes.
But
there's a thing called black wine that they drink.
Oh, the black wine, yeah. Which would be good if... Dear listeners, if you can find some black wine, you just send us over a bottle. We'll give it a try. But it sounds very, healing.
Yes.
The black wine. But for this book, we decided to split the difference between the Italian subject matter and the Irish author. So we're going to do Irish espresso, which is very simple to make. A shot of espresso.
Run down to Starbucks and get a shot of espresso.
Dump on it a shot of Jameson or Bushmills, depending upon if you're a Northern.
Is it on ice?
No. It should be hot.
Okay.
And then just a little shot of whipped cream on the top.
I would say that if it's really hot where you are, because it's very hot in Doppeltown, put the whole damn thing on ice.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And put it in a blender.
And put it in a blender. Or just put a little bit of sugar and just a little bit of a half and half in there and stir it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there it is.
There it is.
The Irish espresso.
Clink, clink. Chin, chin.
Chin, chin.
They say.
Okay, so
that's
we're back.
The drink.
There it is.
But we didn't really go anywhere.
We didn't go anywhere.
We paused
and we started again.
Yeah. So before we end, the question I would ask you is, number one, would you recommend this book and why?
I would not recommend this book.
Okay.
Why? And why?
Yeah.
Because there are other books I'd recommend first. Honestly.
Okay. So what do you, you're actually saying it's not worth the time to read this book?
Yeah, I guess I am.
Wow.
And
you're usually like a whore when it comes
usually,
to books. You're
I'm really, usually not that harsh.
You're much more accepting than I am.
I am usually much more accepting. I would gladly hand this book to somebody and say, here, check this out, read this and return when you're done. But I wouldn't send someone out to spend $20 on this book, which is what we did.
Yeah, which is what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the truth of it. That's where the rubber meets the road. It's not worth $20.
I agree with you. I think that there's probably better books that deal with the same theme.
Yeah.
Now, can I think of one off the top of my head?
I think
The Divinity Student would be a perfect foil to this book.
Yeah.
Because I think it has a lot of the same ideas.
Yeah. Which is funny. See, now, earlier on in this cast, I was running down Prime Books for being asleep at the wheel because they didn't do a good job publishing this book. They did a very good job of publishing that book.
Was that the same publisher?
Same publisher. Your version was not, but my version was.
So somebody else had already edited it,
yes.
perhaps.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so...
other books...
I mean, Michael Sisko, the guy who wrote The Divinity Student, is in New York City, which is...
It's chock full
of
every waiter's an editor.
Yeah, you can't throw a quarter in a homeless man's cup with also throwing a quarter in an editor's cup. Because they're the same people.
Do you think, what other books, I mean, maybe this is putting you on the spot, but what other books do you think sort of look at the same themes?
I would say Matthew Lewis's The Muck.
Right. I would also say, and I've mentioned this book a number of times, Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, there's another one. I've been sort of listening to the podcast of called Reading the Gothic out there, which I enjoy quite a bit.
Which I think is a pile of shite.
No, I think I really enjoy it. I enjoy it.
I do not enjoy it.
But they publish a book called The Abbess.
Oh, Lord.
Which sounds really raunchy. But we won't be reading that next. Because I'm not paying $20 for a book that I...
Is there another book that you would think has this...
This
theme?
This theme? So The Monk. I would say Shakespeare's Richard III.
Oh.
It's about, a person who has no hopes of reaching power and who simply goes out there and makes it happen. If you need to kill a couple of 10-year-old kids to do it, so be it.
I would read Ayn Rand.
Really? Which one?
Like either the Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged, because
I almost
quite a thing to slog through, but it basically is the same. It deals with the same ideas in another direction.
I was this close, which is about a centimeter, to picking up the three little CD binders of the complete Atlas Shrugged on CD.
That's what I read when I was traveling in Italy. Was Atlas Shrugged?
Are you serious?
Because it was a big, thick book, and I thought it could last me the whole trip. I got so sick of her style of writing, I just dumped it somewhere in Sicily.
It's
probably still sitting on a street corner somewhere.
Awesome. I'm going to Spain in the fall, and I'm looking forward to littering little books all over various hotels of Milan and Barcelona.
If I was smart, I would have just kept tearing pages out and then dropping.
Well, that's what
them,
that's what I do when I'm backpacking. I bring along unbound signatures of books, and I just burn them as I finish them. Well, I need the heat and the light and keep the mosquitoes away.
I don't know why I'm thinking of this book, because I read it a long, long time ago, but I'm thinking of The Magus.
Oh, I've never read that.
I think that
John Bowles.
I think that has the same... That might touch some of the same...
You're probably right, actually.
I read it when I was a kid, so I barely remember.
Yeah. Yeah. Never read that. I remember friends of mine reading that when I was in high school. That must be like... Catcher in the Rye must be something that people read in high school. Smart people read in high school.
Maybe.
Yeah, because I don't know of anybody who's read it, like, no friends of mine have said, hey, I just read this book by John Foles, The Magus. But people used to say that all the time when I was in college and high school.
And there was another book called The Alchemist. Did you ever read that book?
No. Who's that by?
I don't remember. I mean, it was the one I read in high school, and it was a little filthy.
Really?
Well, see, that's good to know.
Alchemy sex is filthy sex. Kind of like, what was the other alchemy sex book that we read? Not for this podcast, but it was for our old book group one that we didn't record.
Oh, it was the one by...
The Memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein.
Yeah.
By Theodore Rotzak.
Yes. Very good.
I like that book.
I wouldn't have remembered that.
Yeah. Jenny just ran that book down.
I suppose Frankenstein's a good, another sort of take on this story, in a way.
Kind of, yeah. Frankenstein is probably the greatest of the Gothic novels.
Right. And it's about, this, right. I mean, it's the same idea. This doing this great act of you think is good, but actually produces an evil.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. these days. But
whatever that is, it says. Who knows?
If you know what evil is, please send your your ideas to necronomapod@gmail.com.
We look forward to your responses.
About evil. Or live, spelled backwards. Think about it.
Think about it. Evil. Love, spelled backwards. Okay, so what have we done it?
I know, we're done.
We're done it. So,
what's our book for next time?
Oh, we should pick one. Should we, you know...
Do you want to do that Castle of Orienteering?
I really don't. Okay. I just want to have read it.
Right. Do you want to do...
I think what we should do is we should...
We'll post it.
We're going to have it.
I think we should just post it. Yeah. If you have ideas, please send your evil ideas for books to necromamapod@gmail.com.
We look forward to your responses. So, with that said, shall
we... Let's put a stake in it!
And fill its mouth with garlic and some and a nice, you know, nice. Like some goat cheese, maybe some rosemary?
Stuffing bruschetta in the vampire's bruschetta. Mouth. And then cutting off its freaking head.
Cutting off his head and then roasting it slowly at about 250 degrees with for 4 hours. And then serving it.
Yeah. All right. All right. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Comrade Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilians have to go.
About her voice being buttered with faith. Uh-huh. But I thought a better line would be her voice was oleoed with agnosticism.
That's good. That's very good.